This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. Today, we put a premium on getting things done fast. We like food fast, we like fast technology, and we don't really like to wait for much of anything. But waiting might actually be the key to doing things right. My guest, Frank Partnoy, has written about this in his new book, and it's entitled Wait, The Art and Science of Delay. He's a professor of law and science at the University of San Diego School of Law. Frank Partnoy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
So I first have to start with this question. In what ways are you a procrastinator?
Oh, gosh. So many ways, unfortunately. I'm an academic, and so any academic projects get put off until the last possible moment, preparing for class, writing this book, for example. I got a nasty email from my publisher last fall, and I had finished about a third of the book and was scrambling to get it done at the last possible moment. So I've been a procrastinator all my life, from early age, refusing to make my bed until the last possible moment, arguing with my mother saying, well, maybe people will be coming over later, but I want to wait until the last possible moment because if I make my bed, I will have wasted all that effort through college and law school. So, and one of the things that I learned from the research for Wait is that I've actually been doing the right thing a lot of the time, that putting things off is often exactly what we should be doing, and that once we understand what time world we're living in, what the right amount of time is for a decision, that often the best thing to do is to procrastinate until the last possible moment.
So was it really, this book, really sort of an exercise in self-justification? Like, let's see if all along my mom was wrong and I was right?
Well, no, not really, but it was one of the motivating factors. But really, the book is an attempt to respond to this crush of technology that all of us face, the 24-hour news media and constant social media and email and all of these demands on our time that are speeding us up, especially in the last few years. A lot of research has shown that we are speeding up in our decisions, and it's making us unhappy and less productive. And so one of the things I wanted to do was to try to stitch together all of the research in the area in different fields, from behavioral economics to neuroscience to psychology, and to try to help people understand in different time frames why managing delay instead of letting delay manage you can be a good strategy.
Yeah, let's actually touch on that for a minute, this issue of people being sort of chained to technology, people sort of always being at the beck and call of their BlackBerries or their iPhones. They're always checking email, they're texting, they're on Facebook, that kind of thing. It's interesting because I've talked to business researchers, and people will often say that counterintuitively, the people who take time off from work very often have time to think of the big ideas because they're not chained to their desk. What's your view of how technology and that sort of instant, you have to do it right now society has changed us?
I think that's exactly right. What you've been hearing is supported by dozens and dozens of studies that show that we're speeding up too much and that technology is leading us to react much too quickly. For example, there's one study that was done by Sanford DeVoe, a psychologist at the University of Toronto Business School, that showed that fast food, you mentioned fast food earlier, that just being subliminally flashed a fast food logo will speed us up in all kinds of counterintuitive ways. So you don't realize you've seen a McDonald's logo, but you've been flashed just for a few milliseconds, the McDonald's logo, that will lead you to read 20% faster. When you're listening to a piece of music, you'll become impatient. You'll feel like the music is taking too long. It'll interfere with all sorts of aesthetic experiences, like looking at photographs. And it's true that people who are just constantly responding to instant stimulus, constantly responding to emails, aren't going to be able to take time to step back. And one of the things that I learned from interviewing a lot of senior business executives was that they resist this. The successful executives carve out time in their day. They don't respond to email all the time. They might just respond once or twice a day. And they book an hour of me time so that they can just sit back, read, think strategically. And really, if you think about it, this is what distinguishes us from animals. The big difference between human beings and animals is our ability to think about the future for more than just a few seconds or a few minutes. And so we should harness that ability.
It's interesting because if you think back a few years to the Nicholas Carr book, The Shallows, he talks about having been speeded up so much that Whereas he once used to enjoy novels, he can't focus anymore on a novel. In fact, I think he says at some point, this could be him or this could be me, that when he's got a couple of tabs open on his computer and he's reading even something as short as an op-ed, which is, you know, like 750 words, in the middle of the op-ed, you think like, I may have gotten an email during this op-ed, so I'm going to, you know, go back and check it. So do you see it sort of changing how people are functioning in terms of that ability to focus, to read novels?
Absolutely. And I think he was dead on. And one of the things that I wanted to do in Wait was to gather all of this evidence, not just about how we make decisions and what kinds of decisions we should make and why we make certain decisions, but about when, to try to understand these details of timing, about why it is we aren't able to sustain our attention for so long. And really, if you look at studies of children and try to understand why it is that certain children grow up to be successful, well-adjusted adults and others don't, a lot of it is related to this ability to delay, the ability to delay gratification. The famous marshmallow studies that show that children at age 4 who were able to wait an extra 15 minutes to get a second marshmallow, that those children end up growing up to get better SAT scores and not be obese and be able to delay gratification in ways that help them in their personal lives, that they have better marriages, they make more money.
I know,
and that all these things are related.
Yeah, it's incredible that the marshmallow experiment with such young kids can predict, you know, weight and, as you said, your likeliness to use drugs, your ability to resolve conflicts. Talk for a minute about what that marshmallow experiment, that famous Stanford experiment, was. What did it ask kids to do?
So the kids, these are 4-year-olds largely, and they were brought into a room and they were presented with a choice. So you can either have one marshmallow right now and you can eat it, or if you can find a way to distract yourself for 15 minutes, then we'll give you 2 marshmallows. So which do you choose? And if you look on the web, there are hilarious videos of these kids trying to find ways to distract themselves for 15 minutes so that they can get a second marshmallow. And there have been more recent versions of this study that have been replicated. But fortuitously, Walter Mischel, the man who was involved in running the initial studies, found the group later on, 14 years later and then later than that, and did follow-ups. And what he found in the follow-ups was exactly what you just described, which is all these other aspects of our lives, ranging from how much we eat to how well we do at work. Do we have gambling problems? These kinds of problems with delaying gratification carry over later on, and the kinds of problems that we have as 4-year-olds translate into our adult lives. And one of the things, the first chapter in Wait is about, is it tries to answer some questions about why it is some people are able to delay gratification and others aren't. And there's a whole area of research on what's called heart rate variability, which has to do with milliseconds long changes in our heart rates. And if we have those that ability to vary our heart rate, to accelerate and brake and get fast and then get slow, that will help us as adults to delay gratification and may be related to all kinds of mental disorders like autism and borderline personality disorder. So there's a lot of follow-up research, but that's basically what the study said.
Yeah, that was really interesting that infants with the most flexible heart rates, and this wasn't 100% true, but in a lot of ways turned out to have fewer behavioral problems later on. So that makes me wonder, is it that the 4-year-olds who are waiting for the second marshmallow, not eating their first one, knowing, you know, if I just hang on, this is going to double. Did they learn it from their parents, from their community? Did they learn that delayed gratification? Or are they just plain born being able to delay gratification?
It's such a great fundamental question, and it's the classic nature versus nurture distinction. And of course, as with most of the questions related in this area, there's a bit of both. Some parents who read these studies and know about them are trying to train their kids. You know, okay, little Billy, let's sit here with the second marshmallow and let's practice delaying so that you can make it even more than 15. You can make it 16 minutes or 18 minutes. And so there are a lot of overzealous parents out there who think that it's all nurture, but a fair amount of it is hardwired in our bodies. And this is a fundamental problem that all of us face, which is that our biology, when it runs into the teeth of technology, often responds in very counterproductive ways. So we're hardwired with fight or flight, but when we confront email and social media, the kinds of behaviors that served us well out in the savannah 100,000 years ago are debilitating today.
When we come back, we're going to talk about Malcolm Gladwell's Blink and about professional tennis. We're talking about what we gain when we slow things down. And my guest is Frank Partnoy. His new book is Wait, The Art and Science of Delay. The conversation continues on WGBH Boston Public Radio. This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller, and my guest is Frank Partnoy. We're talking about the rewards and desirable results that can come with procrastination. His new book is Wait, The Art and Science of Delay. And Frank Partnoy, I want to ask you about Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, which you mentioned in your book, and it came out a few years ago, and it really celebrated the idea of the gut decision, that the notion that you have in the first 2 seconds, you should go with that. You know, what was your approach to this sort of non-procrastination theory?
Well, I think of Wait as being a kind of friendly amendment to Blink. The first two-thirds of Blink did, as you say, celebrate the virtues of 2 seconds. And 2 seconds was a kind of mantra that the public picked up on. And it's nice to think that we'd be able to snap react in accurate ways within 2 seconds. But the last third of Blink talked about a couple of counterexamples, the police shooting of Amadou Diallo in the Bronx and gender bias in music auditions. And so there's maybe people didn't make it to the last third of the book. Maybe they had the kind of impatience that you were talking about before. But I think you're right that the public received Blink as being a kind of justification for snap decision making. And one of the things I wanted to do in Wait was to show that sometimes snap decision making is very valuable and that we do have the ability to process lots of information very quickly, but that sometimes our snap reactions are wrong. Sometimes we overreact based on race or gender or all kinds of biases, and that often we need a bit more time. And in fact, many of the examples in Blink, for example, John Gottman, who did the famous assessment of couples, where he watched couples and could tell just based on a very short video clip whether or not they would stay together, that actually his skills are not 2 second skills, that he took much longer than that in his studies. And in fact, when John Gottman wants to have a couple to assess, he invites them to his private island where he gives them not a 2 second session, but a 2 day session. So it often takes a lot longer to get an accurate impression than just 2 seconds.
Interesting. So it's sort of the notion that, you know, a chemist may say, well, here's what this molecule is, and they may say it quickly, but they're bringing to bear 15 years of experience there.
That's exactly right. And the people who are snap reacting and doing it well are people who have been training for years, that this isn't just a sudden thing that we're born with. That
right.
Anyone from football coaches to all kinds of experts in the sciences, these are people who are very well trained.
I want to read you a paragraph from the book that sort of talks about the peril of snap reacting, which really surprised me. And then you can sort of talk a little bit about this more broadly. Here's what you say. It's in the chapter, A Slice Too Thin. More than 100 studies have shown that bias and prejudice among doctors leads them to treat patients differently based on race. Doctors are more likely to refer a patient suffering chronic renal failure for a kidney transplant if he's white than if he's black. Doctors treating heart attacks are up to twice as likely to administer a thrombolytic drug meant to break up clots in the coronary arteries if the patient is white than if he's black. In general, doctors are more likely to provide treatment and medication, whether for psychiatric illness, cancer, or broken bones, for whites than for blacks. That really surprised me, and it sounds from the book like it surprised doctors.
It surprised doctors. It surprised me. We don't think of doctors as being racist, and yet there are study after study that show that doctors systematically undertreat black patients. And one of the most recent studies that I talk about in Weight found something that surprised me even more, which was this very large sample of doctors had similar results. They were given a white patient and a black patient and asked to treat them, and most of the doctors systematically undertreated the black patient, which is, again, this surprising result. But what was even more surprising was that doctors are now very savvy about these kinds of racial biases and their implicit associations. They know about implicit association test. And so 1 in 4 of the doctors in the study figured out that the study was about race, that it was testing their racial bias. And so they paused, they waited, they took a moment and stepped back before they answered this question about how they would treat the patient. And for that group, for that subgroup of 1 in 4 doctors, they did not systematically undertreat the black patient. They no longer had this bias. The fact that they had taken the pause, thought about the issue for a while, incredibly made the bias go away. So once race was an issue for these doctors, race was no longer an issue.
So the idea is sort of knowing your proclivities and thinking them through before you actually get into the situation where you have to make a quick judgment about, let's say, treating somebody medically.
Exactly right. So knowing before you open the door to go to see the patient that you will have certain kinds of reactions based on race or based on gender, based on certain kinds of cases you've seen before, that understanding exactly what you've just said, your own proclivities, is something that all of us would benefit greatly from. If we know that a fast food logo will speed us up, that it will make us read 20% faster, well, knowing that, and if we've been on a drive and we've seen some fast food logos and we stop, then we can try to counteract that by consciously pausing, by taking a little bit of time to fight against our own hardwired biases.
You also say prejudice is contagious. How does it jump from one person to another?
This also is incredible, but there's a study done by Dana Carney and other researchers that showed that just watching videos and seeing racial differences is something that people pick up on and then spread to others, that there are very subtle cues. A parent walking with a child who is holding the child's hand and squeezes it a little bit harder when they're walking past a black person versus a white person, that this sort of unconscious cueing spreads very quickly among people. And we don't intend for this to happen. But again, there are these implicit associations based on race and gender that we have that, unfortunately, if they aren't checked, can spread very easily and unintentionally.
Now, we do know that people form impressions of each other really quickly, just from a glance, from what the other person looks like, from how they move. How do you sort of counteract that within yourself, that tendency, and it's well documented, for people to make those kinds of instant judgments?
You just have to tell yourself that it's likely to be wrong. So if you're going out on a date with someone and you've seen photos in advance, if it's come from an online dating service, you have to tell yourself that the photo is not going to be an accurate representation of the person, that you will have snap reacted to the photo in certain ways. This is one reason why the International Dating Network, It's Just Lunch, won't let clients see photos in advance of a first date, because when we see a photo, we snap react in all kinds of ways that don't necessarily matter for a long-term relationship, that don't tell you anything about chemistry or compatibility. So they tell people, go to lunch, spend the entire lunch forcing yourself not to snap react. Tell yourself, I don't know enough about this person yet. And then after an hour, make the judgment about the person. And I think we all tend to react very quickly to people based on their faces. And in fact, we can learn a lot about people based on their faces. There are studies that show that it's possible to detect all kinds of information from high school yearbook photos about how successful people will be later in life. You can tell which companies are more successful based on how attractive their CEOs are viewed. And so we get a lot of information from faces, but we also get a lot of bias from faces. So whenever we see a face, we should think, okay, here's what's happening. There are two things. One is that I'm getting a lot of information and processing it subconsciously. But the other is I'm snap reacting to this face, and I should give this person a chance. I should give them a few minutes rather than just a few milliseconds.
I'll tell you an example that you gave that made me question that a little bit. I've done a lot of teaching, and one of the examples that you offer in the book is that watching a few seconds of a teacher, so somebody who's just watched, 10, 20 seconds of a teacher on a videotape, is as likely to have a sense of how they would evaluate that teacher as the people who watched that teacher and went to every class the entire semester. There's something, right, as a teacher that you think, that's terrible. Then what was I working the whole semester for? So how are the people who watch the teacher, and I know that you teach too, how are the people who are watching the teacher able to give evaluations as accurate as people who showed up in class every day?
It's very troubling for me. I just had my first class of the fall semester yesterday to 100 students in my corporate law class, and I actually told them about this study because it's very provocative to think that they have snap reacted and made a judgment about me just in the first few seconds, and that I won't be able to undo that. If I did a good job in the first 2 seconds, that I'm sort of stuck with that, and if I did a bad job, I'm stuck with that as well. And the study didn't show that there's a perfect correlation, but I think it is instructive that students make snap judgments about teachers in the same way they make snap judgments about every other aspect of life. And it's a reason why I tell my students just to be aware of this. And I think you're absolutely right. I don't think they should judge me based on the first few seconds. We should take 3 or 4 months and decide if I've taught you well and if you've learned a lot from my class, then evaluate me well or don't. But these studies show what they show, and the correlation is not perfect. Students still learn a lot about teachers throughout the semester, but it just illustrates that we tend to make snap judgments about people, and once we've made that snap judgment, even if it's unconscious, it takes some work to undo it.
Right. Let me touch on a completely different topic, but something that you say also has to do with being able to wait and being able to think about time differently. You bring up Jimmy Connors and Chris Evert, the famous tennis players, and you talk about them as being able to sort of stretch and collapse time. How were they interesting and unique in terms of their way of thinking about time?
This also was very interesting to me because I had always been taught as a kid and had learned that super fast athletes were good because they were fast. But in fact, the high speed studies of super fast athletes show that they're good because they're slow. And what I mean by that is that they get fast, they perfect their tennis stroke, the tennis return, and get faster than any other player, maybe 50 milliseconds faster, according to some studies, studies done by Peter McLeod, a neuroscientist at Oxford University. And so they get faster by 50 milliseconds. And what that does is it frees up more time during the serve itself. So the serve is coming in at a preconscious speed. A tennis court is 78 feet baseline to baseline, which means they have maybe 500 milliseconds, just half a second. And that is too fast to consciously process information. So what's happening if they have that 500 available? Okay, so you've got 500 to return the serve. If you can get 50 faster at the end, that frees up an extra 50 during the time the ball is coming in for you to identify the ball, to judge its speed, its flight, its trajectory. And what Peter McLeod's studies show is that just that extra 50 milliseconds of time to process information is what distinguishes professionals from amateurs, that getting fast in order to go slow is the key, and waiting until the last possible moment is actually what tennis players and baseball players and cricket players are doing in these super fast sports. And one of the things I found really interesting is that that's a kind of mantra for good decision making at much slower speeds. So you figure out the maximum amount of time available for tennis. It's 500 milliseconds. For a decision in our personal lives, it might be a day or a week or a month. And that's step one. What time world are you living in? And then step two is procrastinate, wait until the last possible moment. And I'd never thought of tennis players like Jimmy Connors or, you know, the great tennis players today as really procrastinating, but that's exactly what they're doing in order to most effectively return a serve.
And Jimmy Connors, you know, my understanding from what he said was that it's sort of when he sees the serve come towards him, which is his great skill, the ability to return serve. When he sees it come towards him, it's almost like he's living in slow motion, even though it's obviously coming incredibly fast.
That's exactly right. And you hear this from a lot of professional athletes and experts in anything at high speed, in the military, in business, where when we have a crucial decision, we face some kind of stimulus. We have a tennis ball coming at us at over 100 miles an hour, that if we're really good at what we're doing, that time does slow down for us, that we enter a kind of zen state. And people who are experts in different areas all report encountering something like this, where they get extra time and they're able to kind of slow down, that they're able to take charge of time during that period, even if the period is rushing by very quickly.
Another interesting thing about waiting till the last second also is, I thought was fascinating, with apologies. You say, in some sense, the bigger the transgression is that you have committed, the longer you should wait to the person that you ought to be apologizing to, because that person needs a little time, right, to digest what you've done.
That's right. And this also was very surprising to me and counterintuitive. I was taught as a child that you should say you're sorry right away. And the studies show that sometimes you should say you're sorry right away, that if you accidentally spill a drink on someone, there's no intentionality, then you need to say you're sorry right away. But for the big transgressions, as you say, that the most effective apologies are delayed as long as possible. And it's really for two reasons. It's one is exactly what you've said, that the person who you've wronged needs time to process information, to figure out all the details, to understand what you did, exactly who was involved, why you did it. So that when you finally apologize, that your apology will reflect their understanding. And the second thing is to give the transgressed party, the wronged party, time to vent, time to express their emotional reaction, to tell you how horrible this was. If you apologize too quickly, then you've taken that opportunity away. And so this is one reason why it's very counterintuitive. We've done something wrong. We should acknowledge that we've done it. If we've done something wrong to someone in our personal lives or at work, you should acknowledge right away that you've done it. But often the most effective apologies will be delayed for days while the other person processes information and reacts emotionally. And it's very counterintuitive. But waiting, again, is a good thing to do.
Can you think of any examples, either amongst people you know or amongst well-known people, where waiting has worked?
Yeah, absolutely. There are several that I talk about in Wait, and I talk about a number of politician apologies, some of which did not go very well, some of which did. I have a kind of politician sexual transgression apology playbook for all the awful things that various politicians have done. But one that wasn't related to sexual transgressions that involved Senator Fred Thompson, I think is kind of illustrative, because politicians, when they do something wrong, often don't apologize right away. And what Senator Thompson did was early one morning back in the Clinton administration, accused Bill Clinton of being involved in a kickback scheme involving the Teamsters. And it quickly became apparent during that morning that he had his facts wrong and that Clinton wasn't involved. But instead of apologizing right away, he waited. He allowed the Democrats time to process information. He allowed the media time to process information about what he had done. He allowed groups to vent over the course of hours and hours throughout the day. And then after a full day of media had passed, that evening he finally apologized and he admitted that what he had said was wrong. And the apology was much more effective because the media had had time to do these two things, to process information and to vent. And he said at the end, paraphrasing a famous quote about eating crow when it's hot, that you should eat crow when it's hot. He very colorfully said you should eat crow when it's warm, not cold, not hot. Sort of the Goldilocks of crow eating.
Right. And it's smart because, you know the media has a 24-hour cycle. They're going to have to go through the motions on this, you know, get it through their system. And he allowed them to do it. And then this sort of capped off their coverage.
Exactly right. And Hollywood understands this as well. Tracy Morgan famously waited several days to apologize as the media processed information about his he had told an anti-gay joke about his son during a comedy routine. And when people found out about it, he could have apologized instantly. But he acknowledged that he had told the joke right away, and then he let several days go past, as the media did exactly what you just said. They processed this information and ran through the cycle, and then by the time they had run through the cycle, then Tracy Morgan came out and he apologized, and people accepted it much more than they would have accepted it had he apologized right away. In Wait, I kind of counterpose Tracy Morgan against Mel Gibson and Mel Gibson's snap apology when he was launched into an anti-Semitic rant when he was apprehended drunk driving in Malibu. And he apologized instantly and then apologized instantly again in sort of a pro forma way. And so I think we can take lessons from people in the public eye that even if we're not in the public eye, are good lessons, which is that the basic lesson is that we should delay. We feel like we should apologize right away, but we actually should wait.
So you think potentially Mel Gibson might be in less hot water than he is if he had waited a little bit?
Yes, he'd probably be in hot water for lots of other reasons, but that one he definitely botched, and he was vilified on the web, and people went after him. And if he had taken his time, then he might be better off.
So I wonder, this sounds so much when you're talking like sort of psychology or sociology, but, you know, you're a professor of law and finance. So I wonder, how do you feel like you're sort of out of your area here? How did you migrate from where you normally are teaching to this?
It's a great question, and I had written three previous books about financial markets and financial market history, and there were really two things that got me started on Wait. One was just my own procrastination and trying to understand why I was being made to feel so guilty for it, because it doesn't seem to have hurt me that much over the last decades, and so I just wanted to understand why we have this anti-procrastination industry that's telling us to get things done right away. But the second thing was the financial crisis that we went through. And I've written a lot about financial market innovation and regulation and the crisis. And I think in order to understand the crisis, we also need to understand decision making. I teach about decision making in the business and finance context. And my view was that Wall Street made all kinds of horrific snap decisions leading up to the crisis. And then regulators made horrific snap decisions in responding to the crisis. And in my early research, I learned a story about Lehman Brothers that was kind of the second motivator for writing Wait, which was that Lehman had tried to design a decision-making course that they had brought 4 dozen of their top executives to the Palace Hotel on Madison Avenue in New York. They had holed them up there with some famous psychologists and decision-making researchers. This was back in 2005. They'd actually brought in Malcolm Gladwell, who had just published Blink.
Interesting.
And Joe Gregory, the president of Lehman Brothers, was very much a go-with-your-gut guy, and he was passing out copies of Blink on the trading floor at Lehman. And the thing that I found was that they apparently didn't learn this lesson about the virtues of delay and decision-making, because they very quickly marched back to their headquarters in Times Square and made the worst snap decisions in the history of financial markets, which blew up their firm. So I also kind of wanted to write a revised version of this course for people who work in business to understand that snap decisions are not always so great. great, and that the big innovations and big leaps forward often take years, and that people on Wall Street should slow down.
Have we learned anything? Do you think Wall Street has learned anything? I mean, here we are sort of just clawing our way out of recession. Do you think if there was another financial crisis, the government, the regulators, the banks themselves would act in much the same way that they once did?
Unfortunately, I think so. I don't think we've made much progress. And if anything, I think the markets have speeded up even more since the financial crisis. The high-frequency trading algorithms are much more dominant than they were. These computer trades now account for about 70% of the major stock exchange volume. So, and those are milliseconds long. We're talking just a few milliseconds of trading where there's no human agency involved at all. So if anything, the markets have gotten much faster. And unfortunately, I don't think that the regulatory fixes that we've enacted will prevent another crisis. So we'll probably, unfortunately, be back in the same boat we were in 2007, 2008, relatively soon.
One final question, and I don't know if this occurred to you at all while you were writing the book, but it occurred to me when I was reading it. You know, there's long been an argument between sort of active and passive investing. So everybody, right, who has a 401k knows whether they have, let's say, an index fund, which just follows the market. They don't buy stocks. They don't care what stocks they have. And then some people obviously have like an Ameritrade account, and they buy Apple and they buy IBM and they buy whatever they buy. And people like John Bogle have argued, you know, people, the individual judgments of individual people are never very good. Did you come away from weight thinking at all, you know what, maybe we should just passively invest because our ability to make decisions on the spot about whether to buy or sell aren't very good?
Yes, I think certainly one of the lessons from the research, really research I've been looking at over the course of the last two decades, is exactly that. It's that when people engage in active trading strategies, when they day trade, when they follow the markets hour by hour, average investors tend to make very bad decisions. They tend to trade too much. They tend to buy and sell at the wrong times. They tend to pay hefty fees when they shouldn't, and that people are much better off with passive strategies. And in fact, if you look at the best investors, the best performing investors, even so-called activist investors, it's interesting that we label people as activist, that they operate much more slowly. And if you ask Warren Buffett about his strategies, he describes investing as approaching lethargy, as an incredibly lazy activity, that he'll be working all the time. He'll be reading financial reports and studying and analyzing. But if you look at his actual trading, he'll wait for years to take on a position.
Right. He says, for the long run.
Absolutely. Wait for the fat pitches is the thing that he says. He says you just get a few fat pitches in your lifetime. Fat pitches right down the middle of the plate, and that you should wait for those and not be trading actively.
We've been talking about how prolonging things can actually give us a better result. It's the subject of Frank Partnoy's new book, Wait, The Art and Science of Delay. Frank Partnoy is a professor of law and finance at the University of San Diego School of Law. Frank Partnoy, thank you so much for joining us. Great discussion.
Thank you. It's been great.
And I see Edgar B. Herwick III entering the studio with a smile on his face and a gallop in his step. What's up, Edgar?
Well, Kara, I'm smiling and galloping because I'm excited. This weekend is my fantasy football draft. Are you a fantasy football league person yourself?
I would not be in a fantasy football league for a million years.
You're not a football fan?
Tom Brady. That's it. That's
all
the
you know?
Person I know.
All right, well, what if I told you that instead of ruminating about whether to draft Tom Brady or Drew Brees as your quarterback, you were drafting, say, Joe Biden or Mitch McConnell, even James Carville?
Now you're talking. I'm
all
listening.
Right. Well, it's now possible thanks to Aaron Michael. He's the guy behind Fantasy Politics. We're going to hear all about it and how you can draft a team to compete against other political junkies and maybe even win some cold hard cash.
Sounds good. I'm Kara Miller.
And I'm Edgar B. Herwick III, and you are listening to Boston Public Radio.
We live in a political world. Courage is a thing of the past. Houses are haunted, children are unwanted. The next day could be your last. We live in a political world. The one we